I'm rich, like a hot noise. Rich, rich, rich. I'll take you out, boy. Jake, that was... I don't have a clever one.
Can't find the segue today.
I don't have a clever one. I have a good one lined up for next week already.
Okay.
I don't know how to do it with that one. This is... Okay. Obviously, there's
I respect the effort, I guess.
Nah, there was almost no effort.
The lack thereof?
Yeah, I gave up.
Really, I tried to Goldsby'd this one.
Yes, I sure did. I Goldsby'd it. Not a lot of ways to spin opening a podcast talking about being rich. You know, yeah. Obviously... At the time that lyric was written, they were also not rich, but they do a better job playing that off than I can.
They're rich now, and we are not.
Okay, let's get right into it, Jake. You are not feeling 100% as we record this.
No, it's I was saying before we went on. I went to a show that started at 11:30 last night, which is too late. I am an old man.
This album, though, will probably make you feel. As young as you feel today, hungover after too late a show.
Yes.
Not able to keep up with the youths.
Man, so many youths having such a good time, and I'm very happy for them. But
let's get into it. We'll let our wonderful guest carry you through this one.
I'm just going to sit here complaining.
Yeah,
like
maybe we'll give her
a
shot at the opening lyric lead in too, since I just pooched that one. Jake, today we're talking about an album molded in the aftermath of 9/11. I'm kidding. Man. How does 9/11 has come up in almost every episode? The timing certainly lines up, but we may make it through an early 2000s album here without too much 9/11 talk. This album does, however, stand out as a pretty apt snapshot of the early 2000s New York music scene, so much so that it was a heavy focus in Lizzie Goodman's excellent book, Meet Me in the Bathroom, which if you haven't read yet, you should absolutely check out. It rules. With an unmistakable aesthetic and an even less mistakable voice, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs stood out and broke through a crowded, deep renaissance of New York rock with an incredible art punk album. Today, we're talking about their 2003 debut, Fever to Tell. Yes,
man.
Let's go.
Like it just sounds like 2003. Yeah, that album.
They rule.
They do. They're so cool.
Yeah, cool is the absolute
so cool.
Proper word for Karen O. Also for our guest today,
aww.
We are being joined by Sarah McDonald. Sarah, what's going on?
Hey guys, how are you?
Hi, Sarah.
I think I'm better than Jake.
I'm okay. I'm
doing
all
right.
I'm having coffee's hitting me now. I'm getting there.
Yeah, me too. I did not do anything cool last night. I went to bed and I read Please Kill Me at 9:30.
See, I'm jealous now.
Also a book fans of this podcast should
yes.
Get.
Yes.
It is, as Blake was saying, that Meet Me in the Bathroom, the oral history of New York rock. Please Kill Me is the predecessor for it. It's the form, you know? So you should read that and then read Meet Me in the Bathroom.
And also... Read Sarah's work. So if anyone doesn't know Sarah,
Sarah's a plug.
Come on. I can botch opening lyric. I'm not gonna botch plugging people's work. This is where I thrive. Sarah is a freelance music and culture writer. One of my absolute favorite writers. She's had bylines pretty much everywhere. CBC, Now, Vice Noisy, National Post. You can find her on Twitter at Sarah S. McDonald and find her work at sarahsmcdonald.com. She rules. Also from the 519.
Oh
yeah, sorry.
Wow.
Yeah. This is actually why I'm
taking
here.
Over.
Yeah,
yeah,
this is becoming a 519 podcast.
Yeah, totally.
I see.
Yes, this is going to be great. So the album we're talking about today is the Yeah Yeah Yeahs' "Fever to Tell" from 2003. Very, very influential album. Not just for its place in Meet Me in the Bathroom and that entire renaissance, but also to kind of have, first of all, that breakthrough in the New York scene at that time was really important to rock music, but also to have a female voice and a female presence kind of at the forefront of that and cutting through. Sarah, you wrote for A-Side in April 2018 mm-hmm. that the Yeah Yeahs
Blake did his research.
Sure did.
Blake did his research. Of course he did.
You wrote that the Yeah Yeahs were the centerpiece of the early 2000s New York rock revival. This is an album, I mean, you're the guest. We had you give us a couple options for what album you wanted to come on and do. Obviously, this is an album that's very important to you. So give us a little bit about why you wanted to talk Fever to Tell.
Yeah, personally or critically?
Let's get into the personal stuff first.
That seems more our speed.
Yeah, we need to break the ice here.
So I can remember where and why I bought every one of those albums from this renaissance, as it were. Like when I bought Room on Fire, I also bought a Jet album at the same time.
We all own the Jet album. Don't worry.
But I remember Room on Fire, and I remember when I bought Antics and Turn on the Bright Lights and Regina Spektor's Soviet Kitsch.
Love that.
That's a good album.
Aside, my very good friend, we bonded over our love of the Strokes. I promise I will segue into the Yeah Yeahs, but she loves the Strokes so much that when they came to Toronto to the Horseshoe Show, she saw them and Kings of Leon and Regina open before them.
Damn. I saw
Strokes at Horseshoe alone.
Know.
I saw Kings of Leon by accident one time.
But I assume after they were the Use Somebody guys?
Yes. We were camping at, Six Flags?
Sure.
In like just on the New York side.
Oh, Darien Lake?
That's the one. Darien Lake. So we were just like camping there, and our campsite, you could hear all the music from. So like we just got like a perfectly clear. We're all sitting around like just drinking at the end of the day, and like Kings of Leon are like playing.
That's funny. I actually have that very similar experience, but with the Yeah Yeahs. When they played Field Trip, I want to say.
Two years ago, yeah.
There you can hear the music from Field Trip at the field where I play softball on Sunday nights. And so I was just standing outfield, and I could just behind me hear the Yeah Yeahs.
Oh my
and I was
God.
Like, this is cool.
That was a beautiful, magical show, and I cried. There was a kid beside me. She was like 4 years old, and she was wearing a Yeah Yeahs t-shirt, and she was just yelling, Karen, Karen. And I just, I don't want children, but that was the only time that my uterus was like, maybe there could be another one of me doing this. Anyway.
That would be my only reason to want children, is to do like what Drew Fairservice does with his kids, where he just like brings them to shows and stuff. It's like, yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I can see it.
Sarah, is this the same friend who went and saw Julian speak in Hamilton?
Yes. Blake and I hung out last weekend, and I was telling him about this, so that's why he has that insider info. Julian Casablancas at McMaster talking about why fascism is bad.
I mean, agree.
Should be self-evident, but
I agree, Julian. Go on.
Anyway, to like segue this back to me, I don't remember buying this record, but I just remember the big pull that it had over me. And somebody asked me once, like, how I became a music journalist and like, did I read criticism when I was younger or anything like that? And I didn't really. Like, I have such an emotional, visceral connection to music. And that's what I had with this record. It was listening to Karen. It was all of this energy is so raw and it's so emotional. And I am a big time Scorpio, so I'm very emotional.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about that. You said, obviously, you remember all of these deep emotional connections you had to all these albums. When or where did Fever to Tell find you, and kind of how did that stick for you?
I was in 11th grade, so I found the record in around 2004, and that was my big shift into rock. Like, that's when I decided I was gonna be like the rock and roll chick, and that was my brand before I even knew what a brand
so you
was.
Are becoming the grade 11 rocker chick, becoming the coolest.
I'm not at all cool.
Grand River?
No, I went to Cameron Heights.
Oh, Cameron Heights.
Okay. Shout out Golden Gales.
I went to Queens for 4 years. I still don't know what a Golden Gale is.
Is Queens a Golden Gales?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no idea either.
I don't think I know what Concordia's team was called.
Did you not have a lot of school spirit when you were in Montreal?
No, weird, right? You have to be conscious to have the school spirit.
So around that time, that's when I started to get like really deep in my feelings and journaling and stuff. And then unfortunately, boys started to appear. And that's sort of the catalyst.
Always a bad call when the boys appear.
Yes. My best friend at the time, I liked to describe a relationship as he was Seth and I was Anna.
Okay.
Oh, that hurts me in my soul because I know exactly what you're talking about.
this Seth Anna situation was going on as you found Fever to Tell. And
then a bunch of other boys who I liked in the summer. Like 2005 was like when I really came into it. And I guess I'll tell you the story about my first sort of boyfriend and how we egged his house blasting this record.
I hate him already.
His name was Fohawk Tom.
Perfect. As someone who is not from a small town, I feel like I hear a lot of people from small towns who refer to people in that like descriptor name, nickname. Like everyone's nickname was just like a thing about them and then their first name.
My friend and I, we used to, all the guys that we liked, we would give them nicknames. I think like one of the guys she liked, she named him Lettuce or something. And we would shorten Fohawk Tom to FHT so that no one would understand who we're talking about. It was this sort of code between us.
I like it.
His Mohawk was terrible. I think he actually tried to do a real Mohawk once. This guy's like, there's so many different levels to him. Like he went to England for a week and then he came back and he's like, by the way, I'm British. And he had an accent again. It was
perfect.
Just,
he was is he the lead singer of Third Eye Blind?
He's a douchebag of epic proportions, but I really liked him at the time. But yeah, so he broke my heart. And the first thing I did was I cranked this record and that great line in Black Tongue, boy, you're just a stupid bitch right. And girl, you're just a no good dick. And it's just so angry. You can keep your black tongue. Well, I found out the mortuary. You know.
That's such a great song.
It is.
That song was meant for that situation.
It's a great album for a spectrum of emotions, really angry or really just silly or really sexual or really soft. That's why I love this record as much as I do now. And I don't think I really recognized it then. It was just music. It was just, I remember getting into a little bit of a fight with somebody who I worked with at Noisy. And I was trying to explain to him, like, it was this really like sort of pretentious conversation of like, you know, why these bands meant a lot to me. And, you know, like, oh God, like, you know, I live in New York and everything's so great. And, you know, like, obviously this is, you know, beneath me in some kind of way. And I was like, when I was 16 and I lived in Kitchener, Ontario, where I just had strip malls, this was a fucking revelation for me. And, you know, you could just love it for what it was. It didn't have to be critical. It didn't have to mean anything more than just this got me in a way that other things didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
I get that.
Even if I wasn't, I think I might have just painted myself as this, like, crazy wild child that
But not at all. I completely get that. You know, Yeah Yeah Yeahs is a band that I found well after that, because at that point I was, like, almost strictly pop punk and emo stuff. But I absolutely see where that could come up with this album, because it rules and because it does go in a couple different directions and a couple different emotional vibes. Also, you know, we're going to talk about a little later the... I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but having a...
Please do, most men do.
It's a music podcast hosted by two white men.
That's what I was... That is exactly the point I was going to try to highlight.
It's because Blake is so sweet that it's really easy. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. We are going to use that as a note to take a quick break. We're going to get into the meat of Fever to Tell after this. All right, so it's the year 2000. Karen O, Nick Zinner, Brian Chase. It's like, yeah, you know what? We're bored in New York. Let's start a band. Karen O told Elle in 2017, quote, I was all about getting free and causing trouble. Like, if I had a night where I didn't cause trouble, I'd be really disappointed in myself. I lived for it. I had a lot of buddies who were just as into causing trouble as I was. So the boredom and the dormancy of the New York scene kind of come together here for Karen O to just tell Zinner, hey, let's start a rock band, kind of on a whim. They start messing around on a drum machine. They write four songs immediately. They overhear someone saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're like, you know what? That's the name. This is incredibly cool and casual way to become an awesome rock band. Just like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's do it. So they talked a lot within their friends and within that scene about, hey, we have this band and like we're cool and stuff like that. So in 2000, they get asked to open for the White Stripes at Mercury Lounge. Just from talking up their band, kind of puts Karen O in a bit of a spotlight for the first time. And if anyone has seen videos of Yeah Yeah Yeahs performing or has seen Yeah Yeah Yeahs performing, you might know why that might get some attention, because her stage presence kicks ass. She said she wanted to look like a sweaty punk rocker, pasties underneath a wife beater, covered in olive oil, putting the whole microphone in her mouth, the whole scene.
The Karen O experience.
I cannot describe the Karen O experience. If you are listening to this and haven't seen her perform live, go to YouTube immediately so you get an idea. They made two EPs in 2001 and 2002, which received some acclaim. At that point, they had said their aspiration was just to be able to open for cool bands in cool venues. But as things went, they got a lot of attention. They self-financed Fever to Tell despite major labels being interested in them. Dave Siddick of TV on the Radio helped them produce it. They asked him basically because they didn't know anyone else to ask to do it, and they were self-financing. It was eventually released through Interscope in April of 2003. It is 12 songs, 36 minutes, which, as we've discussed on here, Jake, is the perfect album length, and it's just like constant motion on this one. The sound is pretty unmistakable. Zinner's guitaring is immediately recognizable. Karen O's voice and delivery have maybe been imitated, but no one really comes close. It's like this kind of smirking at you as she flips you off. And
I don't mean this as a negative or a criticism by any means, but this album, I think more than any that we've really talked about, like in the Third Eye Blind episode, we kind of talked about how that album sounds like 1997.
Yeah.
This album sounds like 2003. Like just like the guitar tone, the production of it, the way her voice goes in and out of the songs over with no bass. Like it's so 2003.
Yeah. And the one guitar, one drummer, one singer, like it doesn't, when you listen to it, it doesn't sound that simple. They do a really good job of making that much bigger than it is. And then obviously the music here is good and the songs are great, but just the Karen O appeal is such a big part of this. She told Rolling Stone in 2019, Rebel Outsider Kids Unite. Music is where I get to be that person. I'm pretty shy, reserved, mild-mannered day to day, but in that arena, that's where I get to be the destroyer and defender of all, which is, you know, cool. That's if that's the character you want to cast for yourself, that's an awesome one. Lizzie Goodman in Elle in 2017, she had been working on Meet Me in the Bathroom at this point, but this was a separate piece for Elle, called this something rare and special, the wildest, freest, dirtiest, most unencumbered rock star of her era. Karen may have been one of the only girls in a boy's world, but many of those boys wanted to be her. Everything about this album is cool. Even the album art rules. It's done by Shun, the artist, and a friend of theirs. It kicks ass.
I've been listening to this record in a really long time before prepping for this, and I think it's interesting to me how similar but also completely separate it is when you just comment how she said, or how Lizzie Goodman said that she was the girl in a boy's world, which obviously is true because that's how the music industry works, but especially the rock industry.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me if you compare her and her attitudes and her sound to like Kathleen Hanna and like Bikini Kill and Riot Girl sound, and it's very... not like they're obviously different sounding bands, but they're sort of also not in a way. Like it's interesting to me the parallels between like what the Riot Girl movement was trying to do in the punk movement and then what Karen O was trying to do in the 2000 New York rock scene movement. And it's just striking to me how those attitudes are very similar and they both kick a lot more ass than a lot of the male bands.
There's this anecdote in the book, which is why it's good. I think people should read Please Kill Me if they haven't before. It's an insane read and men are terrible, as we can all agree here. But Debbie Harry in Meet Me in the Bathroom, as Karen O is retelling this anecdote, she's like 20 years old talking to Debbie Harry and she's like, oh, what is this like or anything like that? And Debbie Harry is just really kind of cynical and she's like, well, just enjoy it. And there are a lot of parallels to be said of the New York punk movement in the 70s and in the early 2000s. Like, New York in the 70s was obviously devastating, but then New York in the 2000s was devastating for another reason. And I think it became a little bit more devastating as, you know, the internet happened, which is, I think we can all agree, a little bit of a devastating thing, as good as it is. You can see the lineage between any woman in pop or rock music, from like Debbie Harry and Patti Smith and Lydia Lunch, and then like Kathleen Hanna and Susie Sue, obviously, and kind of upwards to the 2000s. The point I'm trying to make here is it's very difficult to be a woman in rock music.
No doubt. And that comes up on the album. Jake, we get into, I think, every episode now, album sequencing and track listing.
Oh, you nerds.
I don't think you could pick a more appropriate start to an album than Rich, though. Pretty much sets the tone.
That's amazing.
Pretty much lets you know what the next 36 minutes are going to be like right there. Yes, we're nerds. We get into album sequencing every time.
I do have a lot of thoughts on the album sequencing of this album specifically.
Like, my coworkers at Noisy Canada, we would always get into these debates. My very good friend, Phil Whitmer, who I love very much, he's a purist when it comes to track listings. Like this is what it's supposed to be. Like, I'll listen to stuff out of order all the time.
Interesting.
I always have things on shuffle, and it just hurts him if I'm like, oh, I'm just listening to it on shuffle. Why not?
I get that to an extent.
It depends on the album.
Depends on the album. And I feel like I used to be a much more of a purist. I used to be like, listen to the album. You're listening to an album. Listen to the album. I would obviously never listen to an album on shuffle for like the first time I'm listening to the album.
Oh, I've done it.
Really?
Just let go. Just let go.
It's anarchy. Yes. The thing I like about the album sequencing here is that I love Maps, Y Control, and Modern Romance as a three song arc. And then with the hidden song, Poor Song at the end, it's just like those songs fit together really well for me, I think.
I was going to say the same thing. I think this is one of the first albums we've talked about where a few albums where the first half is like really strong and then it kind of tapers off. This album, I actually think, not that the first half isn't strong, but I think it's the opposite. Like, I think the back side B of this album is like flawless.
Yeah. And it's maybe they disagreed or the label disagreed or something, but Date with the Night and Pin were the first two singles, and then Maps and Y Control didn't come out until almost a year later, like into 2004. So in retrospect, obviously, like, how is Maps not your lead single?
Right.
But we're going to talk a lot about Maps, but you know, I don't know. Did they maybe feel like the punkier, faster, more upbeat songs were better breakthroughs?
I mean, I guess at that time? Think of what it's like being a woman and the first song that
your love song
is your love song.
It's true.
You know?
Yeah.
And I love the way that the album starts so aggressive and it feels like you're going, like it's the arc of a night, right? Where you're like, you're starting out and you're so excited and then you kind of go and you reach your pinnacle. And then the last four songs are that dawn daybreak where everything's really quiet and it's a different kind of feeling. But if you lead with that, then I think you're risking being pigeonholed.
That's fair.
I will say to that point, as a less musically diverse person when this album came out, mm-hmm. I liked this album when it came out, but I didn't love it. I obviously bought it because I heard Maps and I was like, that's a great song. And then I remember listening to the first time and being like, I don't get this. And it was too abrasive.
Was it like
for
too
me?
Performancey? When I was preparing for this, I reread a bunch of reviews and it's just like, oh God.
That's been my least favorite part of doing this podcast is like,
yeah.
Go, because you have to do it, right? You have to, are some bad.
The pitchfork one is the worst, I think. But like one of my favorite pastimes, also
old pitch reviews are incredible.
Yes! Oh my God. I love, my favorite one, I think, is The Stills. Logic Will Break Your Heart. I love that album. But like Lauren Mitchell and I would talk about that Pitchfork review and how terrible it was. But like this one, especially, it's terrible. It's really, really awful. And it's so misogynistic. And he's just like pinning everything on Karen being performance. But like the core, the centerpiece of this group is Brian and Nick, you know, like they're the only things that are authentic, but everything else is like pastiche or whatever.
Interesting.
And it's horrendous. Like, yes, it's performance for a reason. If you want to call it art punk, then there's got to be some level of performance there. But to just separate her as the most inauthentic part of that group, and then like you're not going to get it unless you hear the instrumentals, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that's what my thing was. I think with this, with a lot of bands that I like now and I listen to now, that like it's a stupid phrase and I don't think it's actually a thing. But like I wasn't ready for this album at that age. Like I think it was just like, I was very much into, like, if it's not ska and it's not emo and it's not pop punk, I don't want to listen to it, first
like
of all.
I like how you led with ska.
Even then, though.
I know who I was.
Even then, though, like, we've talked about a lot of pop punk albums. You were also just like, no, not right now.
Totally. Yeah. Like, Fall Out Boy, I skipped entirely back then, which seems like would have been right up my alley.
Wow.
But, like, this album, I was just like, it was just, for me, it was, like, too weird. And I was like,
I mean, if you look at the stuff that came out,
like,
what did you listen to from that period? From, like, did you listen to Is This It? Room,
yeah, I loved The Strokes. I loved Interpol.
Yeah. This is left. This is totally left of that.
Not like, obviously The Strokes and Interpol are great, but they're very basic in a way. Like they're just rock, five guys making rock music or four guys making rock music.
Yep.
And I think that's, you know, that's maybe part of the point of having, to your point, Sarah, these as lead singles and to have the kind of album structure like that. Karen O told Lenny Letter in 2017, I had to scream and break things to make people listen to me, but they did. And then, you know, that kind of opens you up for the back half of the album, which is a little sweeter and a little more complicated. And, you know, she told Dazed in 2018, my sole motivation when I make music is to feel something, to touch someone emotionally, to move someone. Well, no shit when you get to the last four songs on that album.
Yeah.
This is Modern Romance, which is, you know, Maps is the best song and the most lasting song, but I love Modern Romance.
Mama.
that song's a really good example of what we were talking about Karen O's magnetism and power. That song is literally a simple drum beat. Nigzer is playing one note that entire song, and you're just like listening to her. Like, it's so captivating.
It's also so timeless. I re-listened to the record on my way here, and that four song stretch, but specifically Modern Romance into Poor Song. She's what, in her early 20s when she wrote that?
Yeah.
It just sounds like it is applicable at any time. It is the kindest breakup song you could ever hear.
Yeah.
It's so sweet. It's so tender. And it's bookended by, I guess, like, you know, Maps and then Poor Song, these like really, really beautiful love songs. But there's just something so captivating about breaking up with Karen O this way. Yeah.
Karen O, ruin my life, please.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, honestly.
So let's quickly go through the reception. You know, this has been a part of each podcast. I don't feel it's super, you know,
I find it interesting to just, especially Pitchfork, because they have gone on such a shift in the last 5 years of like righting their wrongs, so to speak.
Like, yeah. Oh, yes, we're talking about like Taylor Swift and stuff.
Yeah, or even like Bright Eyes. At the time, we're like, fuck this sad emo boy. And now they're like, Fevers and Mirrors is one of the best albums of the decade. It's like, you fucking hated it, though.
Also, don't you dare call him emo. Our emo will, the emo subreddit is going to come after us. They're going to burn this podcast down.
We're taking the fight to them.
Yes.
Wow. So is this the next great war?
I hope so. No, they don't know we exist yet.
I will always, when we're prepping for the episodes, I will search the band name that we're doing in the emo subreddit, just out of curiosity and see what comes up. And without fail, every single one so far, every post that comes up just devolves into an argument about whether or not the thing is emo or not.
Jesus.
And they've got like very strict, like if you call, you know, Sparkle Daddy emo, we're going to roast you because actually, and like, no, this thing is actually Midwest emo pop, not... It's crazy. It's wild. Does not apply there. Although some of the retconning of the reviews is the same thing. So when it came out, you know, it debuted at 67 on the Billboard 200. Date with the Night and Pins were released as singles. The band resisted releasing Maps at first. It didn't come out until February of the next year after the album had already sold about 125,000 copies. It eventually got to over a million in sales worldwide. It went gold in the US and UK. Was nominated for a Grammy for Best Alternative Album, and Maps had several nominations across, you know, both as a song and a video. Rolling Stone loved it and now refers to it as a New York City art punk landmark. The biggest thing though is how people look back on this album now, and Spin's list of the 100 best albums from 1985 to 2005. It was ranked number 89. NME, Pitchfork, and Rolling Stone all had it in their top 30 albums of the decade. It's 38th on Guardian's top 100 of the 21st century that came out earlier this year. So now, if it's not on your all decade or all whatever list, you're missing it. It's near the top on all of them. People love this album in retrospect.
I don't like using this term because I think it may be ascribing too much power to albums. Like, it's an important album.
Yeah, it is. I think it is the most important album, as I have argued before, of that time, because it shows what boredom looks like in a different way, instead of just like a bunch of guys who are like, I'm disillusioned by the way that everything is and exists. So I'm just going to be kind of, don't even know, I love the Strokes. They're one of my favorite bands. But this is so much more important because it is so much more complicated and nuanced than I think the other works are.
And not made by like the son of Albert Hammond. It's like, how bad can it really be?
Hey, listen, this is the one professional time that I lost my shit, when I wrote an essay about Albert Hammond Jr.'s debut album and he like quote tweeted it and said like, no one has ever understood me this way before. And I have that tweet on my wall.
That's amazing. Aww.
So I love Albert. I never want him to be mad at me.
That wasn't like an insult, but that wasn't necessarily meant as an insult.
But he set up to succeed.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not Karen O who is like facing so many roadblocks, both institutionalized and not.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like she is obviously, she's Korean and Polish American, right? Like right from jump, she has a limitation or a marginalization that so many others in that community do not.
By the way, just while you had mentioned writing about this, if anyone wants to read more, Sarah has a piece from 2018 up at A-Side calling Fever to Tell the centerpiece of the early 2000s New York rock revival, as well as a 2017 piece at Noisy, which refers to Karen O as indie rock's beating heart. So guys, make sure you check those out. And again, Sarah's stuff is all at sarahsmcdonald.com and at sarahsmcdonald on Twitter. Before we get into some of the lasting impact of this, I want to talk about the one track that we kind of mentioned a bunch of times and haven't really gone into yet, which is obviously like the track, Maps.
How many of you guys have seen them play that, like, and you just hear the drums live, like, right?
I've never seen them.
Seriously?
Yeah,
I haven't either. I missed that field trip. I was really disappointed.
The first time I saw them was on the Show Your Bones tour, so 2006. I was drinking a lot of Sex on the Beach, that show. That was the first and only time I've ever been to Popeyes before that show. And then in like 2009 and then 2012 or 2013 and then at Field Trip. But every single time, as soon as you hear those drums, it just feels like the first time hearing it live. Oh my goodness.
I think that's such a good way to describe that song. Every time you hear that song does kind of feel like the first time you're hearing that song, which I think is a hallmark of like
a great song.
I understand completely why they didn't lead with this, especially what you were saying about like not wanting to lead with like your cute love song, but like it's such a good fucking song.
It is the best song. I don't even know where I would put this. It would be in a top five of all time, and even then that feels too minimal. Like, well, it's unrankable.
Let me tell you where other people have put it. The song hit number 9 on the Billboard Alternative Songs. More longer term, NME in 2017 named it the number one indie wedding song. They also named it in 2009 the number one alternative love song. Rolling Stone called it the number 6 song of the century so far and number 386 all time. Pitchfork called it the number 6 song of the 2000s. So when we do the like ranking debate segment that we usually close with, I kind of wanted to throw out the like, okay, what are your like weird, not weird, but like off the beaten path wedding songs you could do, like Tom DeLonge having Jimmy Eat World play episode 4. But I thought it would be too... I just didn't want to do it. And you have an actual wedding coming up. And we didn't want Cassie.
And we have a weird, not weird, like we have a off the beaten path a little bit wedding song.
Scott?
Too, so. No, she wouldn't let me.
Real Big Fish.
I wanted to just be beer.
I just came from a wedding where my friend's husband meticulously crafted the wedding song part of the reception.
He had a
new metal section.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and also, I mean, I have feelings about like the Killers, who I love very much, but Mr. Brightside is the millennial wedding song to play.
Yeah.
So if we'll get
you,
there.
Do you want to say what you're going with, or you want to keep the secret?
Yeah, our first dance is going to be to No Children by the Mountain Goats.
Oh.
Because we're not having children.
Amazing.
That song's great. That's the song that closes You're the Worst, right?
Yes, that's actually where we came up with the idea.
And it's funny, so perfect for that show.
I actually saw
too.
The Mountain Goats, and right before they put this song, John Darnielle was like, people ask me all the time to play this at weddings, and I'm always like, no, have you heard the song? I don't want to upset your grandparents.
Maps is a little more of a natural fit.
I think so.
Yes.
So for anyone who doesn't know, it was written about her relationship with Angus Andrew from The Liars. In the music video, she's crying, and she has said afterward that the tears were actually real because he was supposed to show up to the shoot and was like hours late, and she was about to go on tour and thought that he was just like no showing.
Wow.
So real tears. I don't know what's better, that one or in the famous last words by My Chemical Romance, sure, that his screams are real because he tore his Achilles or whatever while filming.
You know what? Let's just give it to Karen. Let's just give it to Karen.
That's fair.
She told NPR in 2013, I think it's really kind of the ballsiest and most punk thing you can do. Write a ballad that's straight from your heart and be able to perform it on a regular basis and just kind of put it out into the world. And yeah, that's pretty.
There's something so pure about when they play it. I think the second time that I saw them, it was for It's Blitz, for that record. So it was at Cool House, RIP Cool House.
Oh, I miss Cool House.
They started up and then she like got a little jittery or something, which is like, that's the best part of watching Karen O. Like, she can be this crazy person who's swallowing a microphone and, you know, spitting beer on you, which I never got and I wish I did. But then there's this moment when she like sort of trips up as she's playing the song, and then she has this beautiful, innocent little smile, and then just it starts again, and then she just like slips into this song. I have a lot of feelings about seeing this live.
It seems so sweet. This song, so good and so beloved that pretty much everyone has covered it. Ted Leo covered it in like a medley with Since You've Been Gone, which is really fun.
I fucking love that video.
Arcade Fire, White Stripes, Macy Gray, Anderson .Paak, Beyonce takes it for Hold Up on Lemonade.
I love that. I was very, very hungover when I watched Lemonade. I was DJing the night before at Unlovable, also RIP.
Unlovable clothes?
Yeah. I walked past it the other day and they were just ripping up pieces of it and throwing it into a junk bin, and my heart just tore in half.
I didn't know
it was like they were throwing your heart in the junk bin.
Yeah,
also.
They were.
That
it
sucks.
Was.
I loved Unlovable.
But we knew that Lemonade was coming out and I didn't want to watch it when I was very drunk when I got home. So the next morning I just sat up on my balcony and I watched it. And then as soon as I heard, you know, they don't love you like I love you, I was like, pardon me? Just, what? Beyonce is singing my beloved Karen O's wonderful song that it sampled. And yeah, Ezra Koenig from Vampire Weekend, he was one of the writers on it. So he brought that sample in and she loved it. And I don't know if they've ever actually met Beyonce and Ezra, but or Beyonce and Karen for that matter. Huh.
I don't want Beyonce to come after us. So instead, we're going to play a clip from my favorite cover of this song from Alt J's Like a Virgin. This is Camp Cope's cover of Maps. Hopefully future podcast guests.
Yes, that would be great.
At least one of them.
That'd kick ass.
Yeah. Kelso has just like a ton of musical taste overlap with us. You know how there are some like musicians who like don't like their own genre?
Yeah. Like Steve.
Yeah, she's not that way. We are going to talk about kind of the impact of Karen O and Fever to Tell after this. So on top of everyone loving Maps and covering Maps and this album being critically acclaimed in retrospect, I think it had a pretty obvious impact on other bands in the genre and then everything that happened around that time. Obviously, there's a huge oversaturation of men in the scene at that time, and her lyrics and aesthetic all attack that. In Meet Me in the Bathroom, Karen O says, "It's hard to know how much that's impacted my career and my drive as an artist, but probably a fucking huge amount." And that's referring to being one of the few women in the scene. Sarah, I know this is something you've written about and feel strongly about, so I will not purport to be able to have that same perspective, so have at it.
So I mentioned Regina Spektor before, and like she was sort of a kid sister, I guess, to the Strokes, and she traveled around with them going on tour. But there, when you're reading Meet Me in the Bathroom, it didn't really click until I was reading it, but Kimya Dawson from the Moldy Peaches, like their story, especially hers, felt really hinged on the Strokes, like the only reason it was included. And I know that that's not the only reason it was included, and I don't want to mean to say that Lizzie Goodman only included them because of the connection to the Strokes, but that's what it feels like for a lot of these bands. It's there, especially the women, they're just there to bolster the men who are in the scene. And Karen, as isolated as I think she felt, and she said it in the book a bunch of times, that it was really, really lonely, and she did find her bandmates to be allies. There's just, where else do you turn? And I think how she did that was to just be this figure of strength and just like really barrel through it like the Kool-Aid man going through a wall, and be that kind of energy, even if she didn't have enough female support around her, if that makes sense, you know, mm-hmm. just to do the best that she could with what she was given.
And I think, you know, you see a lot of these movements in music and these moments in music include women in them. They're, you know, there aren't
all of them.
Yeah,
the
there aren't many that move forward without some female presence.
There's no explicitly feminist, I use air quotes, because but there's no real explicit female centric part of this movement. So like we were talking about Riot Girl earlier and girl power and whatnot, that is completely absent from here and from most of the scenes, I think, that we loved in prior decades and whatnot. And it doesn't feel like until like that one, a couple bits in the 90s and then obviously in the last like handful of years or, you know, past decade and a bit, where women are really kind of coming out and like forming those communities and really around that.
When I said earlier that this record sounds like 2003, I don't think this record and this band gets the credit they deserve in terms of like genre influence.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure if this record gets lumped in with like the dance punk craze. It's not quite as like dancey as like the Rapture, but it's,
yeah,
but it still has those like kind of, you know, the 16th notes on the cymbals and the guitar riffs. And I feel like this record is such in such a place of that, but doesn't get talked about when you talk about that genre. Like you talk about that genre, it's always the Rapture or Liars' first record or LCD or whomever. Not that, yeah, those aren't good bands and good albums, but they're just...
Do you think LCD is a good band?
I've had my moments. But this but this record feels like it should be in that conversation. And it's, other than Maps, I feel like it's... Not that it's been lost to history, because that's not what I mean at all. But like, it doesn't get talked about in that scene. And I don't totally...
But it's because it sits between both of them, right? Like, and right, that's why I think it is the centerpiece. It's, you're looking at the bands that, if you want to say they're like Television or Joy Division or whatever. Right. And then you've got the dance punk ones. Like if you look, I was looking at Art Punk Wikipedia today and like they're listed, you know, with those other bands. So it's, they can apply to one or the other. And I think for a lot of critics and perhaps for a lot of fans too, they don't like that. Mm. So it's got to be one versus the other.
Right. Yeah, I think that.
And James Murphy is such a personality, so he's going to take over everything.
So hard to like. It's so hard to like that band, even though I do.
I think, you know, she has had a pretty clear influence too. Like, there's not a direct musical connection, but you look at someone like Mitski or Angel Olsen, where
Weaves, a great Toronto band.
Yeah.
Jasmine Burke has often cited Karen O. So yeah, like she's all over the place, you know?
Also, I don't know. Is there a fashion influence to all those Christian Joy costumes that were completely impractical?
I mean, look, I'll say this right now because I love Karen, but wearing very bright colored headdresses on stage, not your best move. And I think she's recognized that since then. But yeah, like her aesthetic and her relationship with Christian Joy is, it's as foundational as the sound, I think.
All right, let's spin it back to grade 11, Sarah.
All right, she's finding here. She's ready.
I think it's my favorite Karen O quote about this album. She told Lizzie Goodman for Elle in 2017, "Every now and then I'll hear, 'Thank you so much, you really got me through high school.' Or, 'Thank you, you really got me through freshman year of college.' I don't know what to say back, except for, 'Oh, really? Thank you. I'm happy I got you through that.' But really, in my head, I'm like, I manifested that shit for you. I wanted to get in there like a motherfucker, and that's what I did." So I think, you know, it worked, right?
She did it. Yeah. No, I think I would cry if I met her, and I would really say, like, you helped raise me, and you gave me perspective, and I think license to feel what I wanted to feel. I have a really, really bad relationship with my dad, but I have this memory of him like coming upstairs to my room and I'm listening to this record and it's just so loud and it's Y Control. And he just like looks in and then he just like closes the door.
That was me in my unfinished basement, but with Slipknot and Disturbed.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I was not finding the right music for my feelings.
It's a journey. It's not a straight line.
It's a journey. Okay, so after Fever to Tell, Yeah Yeah Yeah's release, Show Your Bones in 06, It's Blitz in 09, Mosquito in 2013, all pretty good. It's Blitz is considered a pretty influential art pop album as well. Hiatus, brief return in 2017 for the Austin Sound of Sound Festival that eventually got canceled. They've done some shows since. They reissued Fever to Tell on vinyl after, like, I think like 10 years you couldn't find it on vinyl anywhere. And then Karen O has a solo album in 2014, one with Danger Mouse, Where the Wild Things Are soundtrack, and a ton of guest appearances all over the place. Any other thoughts on Yeah Yeah Yeahs before we expand this discussion a little bit to that whole moment?
Not, I mean, a little bit, but I mean, Crush Songs is a great record too, if you're going to listen to Lo-Fi Karen. If you love Maps and that whole arc of Fever to Tell, you'll love Crush Songs, which I highly recommend listening to.
Also just a great album title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just put it right there. This is what it is.
She did this thing for Rookie, and it was like Ask a Grown Up segment, and it was around Crush Songs came in. She was like, being heartbroken is one of the best things that can happen to you. It is one of the best feelings in the world. And I love her for saying that. And you can apply that back to Fever to Tell.
I don't know. As someone who has just not put it out there for a couple years now, I disagree, maybe. We have referenced Meet Me in the Bathroom, Lizzie Goodman's excellent book that you should buy and read a couple times throughout this. Obviously, everyone sucks in the book, which is, you know,
I think everybody's supposed to suck in the book. Yeah. I think the underlying fact, the truth that nobody says is that everybody sucks, period. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Which is
except Karen Howell.
Take down the myth-making.
Yeah. That's exactly what my notes say is everyone sucks, exclamation point, except maybe for Karen Howell.
Also, Brian and Nick, too. They're such sweethearts. Like, Nick Zinner, I love following him on Instagram. It's one of my favorite things because he's just this quiet presence, and they also probably don't suck. So I'm going to go on a limb there.
As much as the people may suck in that book, there are a lot of good bands.
Yes.
There's a lot of good music that came out around that era. I think, you know, the book kind of follows the Strokes more than anything. I won't list all the bands mentioned in Meet Me in the Bathroom because we're already long on time and we'd be here another 5 minutes, but there are a lot. Before we came in here, I asked you guys to come with your three favorite albums from bands who are mentioned in Meet Me in the Bathroom or are a part of the story. I don't know if there's going to be a ton of overlap here, just again, because there are so many bands and, you know, I know what one of Jake's is going to be. I have an idea what one of yours might be, but let's hear it. What are your top albums from bands in Meet Me in the Bathroom in that sort of early 2000s New York rock scene?
Okay. Number three, Hot Fuzz, The Killers, even though they're not from New York, but I love that they're included in the book. Antics.
Vegas Boys.
And number two,
yes.
Interpol. And then number one is Room on Fire, which is the best Strokes album.
Yes, it is.
Ever made.
I have had that argument many times, and you're absolutely correct.
It is the best, the very, very, very best.
Jake, I assume now I know what two of yours is. I forgot that you guys had the same Strokes hot take, and that was part of why when you sent us some albums to do, I wanted to do Yeah Yeah Yeahs over Strokes, because I don't feel strongly between that and Modern Age.
I just like having the conversation.
Because you don't want to like listen to us rant and yell about how Room on Fire is so good.
Yeah, and also because I don't have a strong take on
That's
it between
fair.
That and Modern Age, I feel like I would be the target of the argument.
I get enough. It.
I'm
get
a coward.
It.
I just also Yeah Yeahs are the best.
So. Yeah. I think number three for me is probably Turn Off the Bright Lights.
Okay.
Turn on the bright lights. Yeah. Yeah.
Why would you want to turn them off?
It's true. I think that's probably number three. Number two is 100 Miles Off by The Walkman.
Oh, interesting.
Because I love The Walkman. I'm always torn on which Walkman record is
over
my favorite.
Bows and Arrows?
Those are like the two. Also, I'm a big fan of You and Me as well.
Did you listen to Jonathan Fire Eater at all?
I got into them later when I got into the Walkman. Because I missed the Walkman when I was younger. I got into them about 6-7 years ago.
Right.
Greater's Heaven was coming out.
Yeah.
And then when they went away, of course. But I do like Jonathan Fire Eater quite a lot. And then my number one, like, I'm a big LCD head, even though I have a hard time with them lot of the time.
How do you feel about James Murphy making everybody go to the same therapist as him?
He's a crazy person.
He's insane.
Yeah. Oh, no. I have nothing. I don't really have any good things to say about him as a person. But Sound of Silver is amazing and is my number one.
All right. I had Hot Fuzz at number three as well.
Nice.
Fever to Tell is actually my number two. And then Sylvia Kitsch.
Oh, that's Virginia Spector, so good. Yeah.
That's a good list.
I love Regina Spektor. I don't know. It was tough to pick one of the albums out of all of them.
That was my honorable mention.
Yeah, my honorable mentions were both the Strokes album and and White Blood Cells, the White Stripes.
Oh, I picked Elephant and Get Behind Me, Satan. Those are my...
Elephant's my White Stripes album, I would say.
Yeah. when you were mentioning at the beginning that Carano or the Yeah Yeahs opened for them, did you read that part about Jack White being a little bit intimidated by the fact that they didn't have like a bass player or anything and that there was a woman in that band? And he was like, he immediately took that as a personal affront to him.
Yeah, like, of course. Are they trying to be the White Stripes?
Speaking of guys who are hard to like sometimes, yeah, but your music is good.
I know.
One thing we do at the end of every episode is we pick a song from the album we've discussed to go on what will eventually be a Columbia House Party mixtape. As I say that, I realize I don't think I said the name of the podcast at the start.
Obviously, that's okay.
Obviously, anyone who's listening to it knows what it is, but I gotta...
The nice thing about podcasts is like you have to know what it's called when you're listening to it.
I thought this was like the 519 Propaganda podcast. Yeah,
that's a spinoff that me, you, Lauren, and Anne will do at some point. So we pick one song off the album for the mixtape. We need to pick a song off of Fever to Tell. We can debate it a little bit, but Sarah, you're the guest. This is your album. Which song do you want to put on the mixtape?
Poor Song.
Really?
Yes.
Baby, I'm afraid of a lot of things, but I ain't scared of loving you. Baby, I know you're afraid of a lot of things, but don't be scared of love, 'cause people will say all kinds of things that don't mean a damn to me, 'cause all I see is what's in front of me, and that's you. A fool, but I know you're just as cool, and cool kids, they belong together.
I miss the fact that like on CDs that it was a hidden song and now it's on Spotify and it's a regular track. But
yeah, you want that minute and a half of silence or whatever.
Wondering, is this the end? Is there going to be another song?
Yes. So that is my pick. As much as I love Maps, I love Poor Song a little bit more.
We have also discussed in terms of just mixtape creation theory and how you would actually make a mixtape for someone. Most people know what Maps is. When it came up with Sugar, We're Going Down for Fall Out Boy, like you don't need to put that on the mixtape. Everyone knows that song. If you're trying to give people something new, something they may not have heard.
And like unless it's like really personal and specific. I was a mixtape queen.
Okay.
Ooh, I used to make mixtapes for all of my crushes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But it would always be like it would be album cuts, not singles.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way to go. Most people have heard the singles or can find the singles easily.
Yeah, barring certain songs are just like we did Robin. Dancing on My Own is obviously the pick.
Oh, Don't Fucking Tell Me What to Do? What about that?
We discussed it. I like that song.
That's a great song.
It is a great song.
Hang With Me.
Dancing on My Own is just like...
It's perfect.
Zub said in reference to Sugar We're Going Down and also the Big Mac, it insists upon itself.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe you said that.
No, I don't think that sounds too smart.
Zoob's bringing up the Big Mac was definitely Zoob's. But yeah, it insists upon itself sometimes. But in this case, I think I like your choice. We can go Poor Song. I think I probably would have gone Modern Romance if it were just me, but it's not just my mixtape. It's all of our mixtape.
I think I would have gone No, No, No.
Oh, yeah. That's a great song. I think it's also the longest on, I think it's like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's the longest song on the album.
To me, that's where the album like kicks into gear.
Really?
For me, yeah.
Interesting.
Like I was saying, I like the first half of the album, but that's where I'm like,
I'm all in.
Fuck yeah,
let's go. Fuck yeah, I'm all in.
So a key figure in this band in that moment, Nick Zinner, the guitarist in Yeah Yeah Yeahs, also the guitarist and keyboardist in Bright Eyes. the dude has a resume.
For the best Bright Eyes album, but that's a whole other conversation.
What is it? What's the Bright Eyes
Digital
album?
Digital Ash.
Really?
Yeah, I love that album.
Yeah, that is not the best Bright Eyes album.
It's absolutely.
We'll save that for a future Bright Eyes episode.
It absolutely is the best Bright Eyes.
Sarah, thank you so much for coming on. This was so much fun.
Yeah,
you had fun too.
No, this was terrible. I never want to see you guys again.
Yeah, I hope you had fun.
I did. Thank you. I really did have a good time. Thank you guys.
Guys, as a reminder, Sarah's a freelance music and culture writer. And she's the best. You can find her work at sarahsmcdonald.com. Find her on Twitter at sarahsmcdonald. Read her two pieces on the Yayayas that we referenced earlier for A-Side and for Noisy. Check her stuff out. She's the best.
I'm going to cut you a check later.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Try the fish.